The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN+.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Dr. Charles Lim. Dr. Lim is the Francis A. Suey Professor of Otolaryngology.
Very good.
Thank you. Man, I had to phonetically write that out on this piece of paper, and we're not done. And the chief of the division of otology. You see, it's simpler. I should have gotten that. Neurology and skull-based surgery at the University of California, San Francisco. He is also the director of the Douglas Grant Cochlear.
Perfect.
Thank you. Implant Center at UCSF and holds a joint appointment in the Department of Neurosurgery. All right, I'm going to pause my introduction, which, you know, I was fumbling over, and ask you to explain what all of those words mean to our audience.
Sure. So otolaryngology is what most people think of as ear, nose, throat medicine.
Well, that would be much easier.
Yes.
Yeah.
And otology, neurootology, skull-based surgery is what I do, which is I'm a kind of an ear surgeon, so I specialize in surgical treatment of ear conditions, so whether it's deafness and cochlear implantation or ear infections or ear tumors.
Yeah, when you say it like that, there's no problem. We all get it. So in addition to these impressive degrees and positions, Dr. Lim plays the saxophone and even directed a jazz band when he was going to college at Harvard. And I became acquainted with his work when he gave a TED Talk around working with improvisation and looking at to study what goes on in the brain. But let's checkmark that, because I want to start with a great small quote of yours. You said, creativity is magical, but it is not magic.
Yes.
Yeah. Why?
Apparently I said that. For a lot of reasons. Now, let me give you a little backstory. So you mentioned I was a saxophonist. I was never a good saxophonist, but I was never a bad saxophonist. I was good enough to know that I wasn't good. And so I decided that what I liked most about saxophone was this idea of improvisation. As a kid, you know, when you're just sort of learning who you are and music's starting to appeal to you, I think that some people just find it in what they're listening to. And for me, what I found it maybe the most important thing for me was to just play what I felt like playing. And that process of generating new music really captivated me. And I never let go of that bug, that feeling of sort of like what it's like to come up with something new that nobody told you what to play. And then many years later, I sort of returned to that idea when I finally learned enough brain science and acquired some skills and methods to actually be able to do so, to unravel this thing that even though it felt like it was magical, I knew had to be a neurologic process.
Wow. Okay. I want to play a short piece of music right now, so that we can talk about some of the work that you've done. So this is one of my favorite albums in the world. It's from the Köln concert by Keith Jarrett. And for people who might not know, Jarrett is actually improvising this entire concert. So you studied what is happening to the human brain when someone like Jarrett is doing just that.
Yes, I tried to. You know, I think neuroscience has sort of traditionally shied away from something like jazz as being too complicated or maybe off limits. I was naive enough to feel like it could be done, or at least that we could learn more about the creative brain than we knew by trying to look at a jazz musician. And I was convinced that jazz was the right model for creativity in neuroscience because of the fact that jazz happens quickly, spontaneously, on the spot, and the musicians can kind of do it over and over again for hours and hours. So I thought that as far as being adaptable, being flexible, jazz musicians would fit the bill. And so I, yes, I tried to take what Keith Jarrett does naturally in a concert like that, and that's an amazing, you know, opening movement to that concert, and take a look inside his brain.
So, but you had to like, stage a jazz concert inside an MRI machine.
Sort of, yeah. I mean, it's a weird gig for most musicians because there's not really an audience.
The pay is so shitty on that.
Actually, the pay might have been better than some
gigs. The pay was better. All right. Good point.
But, you know, you're lying down. You're in this big tube. You can't move your head. It's weird. People don't play piano lying down.
It's hard to fit a piano in there.
Very hard. So we had to have a special small piano.
How'd that work?
So that was interesting. So, you know, when I set out with this idea that I want to do brain scanning and I need an instrument, piano was just the first idea I had. It just seemed to make more sense than trying to get a tube in there or something like that. And so I wound up working with an engineer. It took us about 2 years to make a piano that was small. It had 35 keys, full-size keys, but not full range, that you could play in there, that had no magnetic metals in it, and so was safe, and then could also produce instrument, what we call MIDI signals, to trigger a computer to play piano samples.
Mm-hmm. And so you created this like with an engineer?
Yeah. Basically over a 2-year process, back and forth, trading this instrument back and forth and tweaking it and finally getting it to work right. He did all the heavy building, but I did the design and the concept and making sure it actually worked.
But you guys didn't live in the same state?
No, across country.
How'd that work?
Literally, I was in the sort of the dungeons of the NIH, National Institutes of Health, in Bethesda, D.C. Mm-hmm. He was someplace in the suburbs of California. Uh-huh. And I would gingerly FedEx this precious piano that got more and more precious as the time went by because it was getting better and better. Uh-huh. Across the country, hoping it actually, you know, made it to him and didn't get dropped off in some, you know.
Oh, my God. So
gutter
like just,
somewhere.
Like just unseemly amounts of bubble wrap to try to...
Yeah, you know, pretty much. That's pretty much what it was.
That's amazing. All right, and so you built this thing, and then you put the musician inside the MRI, and you had to there's a control aspect to this, right?
So yes, always.
What was that?
Yeah, so whenever you're looking at brain activity, it's if you want to try to really learn something, you need a comparison state, what we call a control condition. So you can't just have somebody play piano and improvise, because you need to know what aspects of that activity were actually unique to the improvisation and not just required to play the piano. And so for us, we developed a memorized control condition where musicians were memorizing a composition and then playing it. It was based on a 12-bar blues that we had written. And then we also did a paradigm where they were playing a scale up and down and then improvising just on the scale with the same rhythmic notes that they played the scale in. So we tried to come up with things that were musically relevant, familiar, and natural, things that a jazz musician would do in an ordinary setting, so that the actual experiment reflected the art.
So when they're just performing the sort of written piece of music and they're not improvising, what's going on in the human brain?
Oh, a ton of things. I mean, playing any musical instrument is one of the most wonderfully engaging activities for the human brain. I mean, literally all areas of the brain are active during any complex musical behavior, such as playing a piano. Now, improvisation adds another layer on top of that, even still, because you're not playing something that is being directed to you by a piece of sheet music or something you've memorized. You're figuring out what to play on the spot. And it turns out that that simple conversion of making it up as you go spontaneously changes the brain activity in a fundamental way.
Okay, so you've got your control. You see what's going on, a lot going on in the human brain. And then you have them improvising. Is there something very specific that is different in the brain when they're improvising?
Definitely. So many things change in the brain. But if I had to sort of summarize it, I would say it the following way. In general, when you go from a memorized state to a creative state, the brain kind of like it gets amped up in many ways. Like, so there's huge parts of the brain that are higher in activity. So all of the sensory motor processing areas of the brain go higher in activity, even though you're not necessarily hearing more or playing more, so to speak. But it's almost like the brain is getting prepared to be able to execute whatever comes to it. And to do so, it requires more usage of neural resources or more engagement of the brain. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that happens that I think is maybe most fascinating is that there's a large suppression or deactivation, shutdown, whatever, however you want to call it, a large reduction in activity in what's called the prefrontal cortex of the brain, which is where things like consciousness reside and where we're learning now things like creativity reside.
So, I mean, if I'm hearing you right, what happens is the part of our brain that self-censors and judges goes down.
Yes, and I always like to say these are not like the jazz areas of the brain. Okay? So, like, these are parts of the brain that are multifunctional. They play a huge role in everyday activities. But one of the key functions is conscious self-monitoring and self-censoring. So, for example, right now at this moment, I want to make sure that I don't say something that is ridiculously dumb. And so this part of my brain is very active, filtering my output, making sure that it's appropriate, hopefully correct. And if I'm about to say something wrong, it's guiding me in the other direction. That part of the brain is shut down during a jazz improvised solo.
Wow. I mean, you know, we talk about this so much in our work, frankly, with little to no science, right? So when you are beginning your classes at the Second City in improvisation, it is all about eradicating fear. And it's all about creating exercises that allow people to get out of their judgment brain. And so this is the thing that was fascinating when I first sort of stumbled upon your work, was sort of realizing like, oh, no, our hunch was kind of right on that. To do this work and to do it effectively, you can't be in a place where shame is creeping in. And I think – and I generally kind of feel that that's probably true for most creative artists. I don't know if that there's other ways of examining that, but it strikes me that anyone who's involved in creating something original, creative and original, has to have a level of fearlessness.
Yeah, I think that's entirely correct. Now, you know, the more I've thought about these sort of processes in the creative brain, the more I've come to think that there's universal traits that are shared by the creative brain, regardless of what genre or discipline is being performed or done. So I think the jazz musician's brain is probably not that different than the spontaneous painter's brain or the poet's brain, the rapper's brain, or the comedic improvising brain. And there's been a lot of sort of musicians and artists' reflection on the thing that they had to learn was how to get out of their own way and how to stop, be willing to take a risk, you know. And I think there's this notion that you're pretty vulnerable, you're pretty exposed when you're improvising because you're kind of putting yourself out there. And I think the jazz musicians have kind of, I don't want to say perfected, but they have made improvising such a commonplace thing for them. That's how they communicate. Everything they do is improvised, essentially. That they've kind of developed this art form in music to such a high degree that it really provides a great model for study. And I think that the comedians that are at Second City are another great example, people that have trained their brain to enter this very interesting and probably very common brain state almost at will.
Right.
And that, to me, is the beauty of it. It's like a real opportunity for us to unravel the workings of the creative mind and actually try to reveal something that might both be fundamental, a fundamental truth with respect to how human beings are, but also shed some light on where we're headed as a society.
I think you can see that a little bit in sports, too, sometimes. And I think back to those great Bulls teams in the 90s where they just operated like jazz. And I know Phil Jackson, the coach, was a huge jazz fan.
Yeah. And by that, you don't mean the Utah Jazz.
I do not mean the Utah Jazz because we beat them, didn't we, when they should have won.
Yes. I was sadly a Knicks fan during that time. And
it was
a little brutal. but I'll get over this in a minute here. Now, you know, I think that sports and high-level athletics, maybe high-level anything. So, you know, I'm a surgeon. I will tell you that I have said this before. When surgery is going at its best, it doesn't feel that different than when a jazz solo is going at its best because there's a flow state involved. Ideas are coming naturally. Things seem effortless. They're smooth. There's something that's fluid. It just feels very comfortable. And I think that you see that in music. You see that in sports. And I think you can also change that performance in something like sports when pressure's on the line. And this is why somebody who can make, you know, free throws all day long, when they step up to the line, when the game is, you know, at stake, they can blow it. And that is the brain interfering with its own already perfectly well-mastered subroutines. But for some reason, if there's now $1 million at stake to make the next free throw, you balk and you mess it up.
Right. Malcolm Gladwell has this great podcast, Revisionist History, and there's a whole episode on Rick Barry and Wilt Chamberlain. And, you know, of course, Barry, amazing free throw shooter because he did it underhand. And the two seasons where Wilt Chamberlain shot free throws well, he did it underhand, but he didn't do it the rest of the time. And it was simply, I mean, he didn't want to look frankly, not macho.
Yes, I'm sure there's definitely, you know, personal style attached to anything that's sort of in a way aesthetic or athletic here.
Yeah, just because we have the science doesn't mean that we're going to take it.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I mean, let's keep in mind here, the neuroscience of something like creativity is really in its infancy. Mm-hmm. And so because it's in an infant state, I don't ever want to overstate what we know. I mean, the amount that we don't know far exceeds what we know. And really where we are is at the level of exploring a new world and finally coming to the realization that it's a world worth exploring.
Right.
Not that we've actually already mapped a lot of it out. I mean, truly, like, if you think about questions of significance to artists and people's daily lives, we've barely scratched the surface in terms of really understanding complex human behavior.
Adam Grant's book Originals talks about the virtues of daydreaming. And I'm curious if there's any correlation between a dream state and improvisation and the things you've studied.
So huge correlation in the following way. So there have been some neuroimaging studies out from the NIH on dreaming. And it turns out that a lot of what's happening in a dream state is similar to what's happening in jazz improvisation, in that there is widespread deactivation of the prefrontal cortex. Now, that's pretty interesting when you think of the fact that dreams may be, in some ways, when we're at our most creative. I mean, when you think about some of the dreams you have, I mean, they're completely nonlinear, and the references are coming in a very what appears haphazard and chaotic way, almost at random. Now, that makes some sense when you think about the fact that these sort of mechanisms of the brain that are designed to keep things in order and logical and sensible are being suppressed when you're asleep.
You just recently did a study to see how emotional expression affects the brain's creative network, right?
Yes.
So what'd you discover there?
Yeah. So, you know, we wanted to get beyond this idea of just on off, because there's this notion that the brain is creative here, the brain is memorized here. And to me, that was just too simplistic. And there must be all of these things that sort of act as co-modulators for brain activity during a creative task. And to me, you know, the one real purpose of music, I think, might be to convey emotions. Because music might convey emotions better than any other form of communication that exists. It might. I mean, you know, at least some people would argue that it does. Now, at the very least, it's very good at conveying emotion. Better that than conveying other things like specific thoughts. Now, we put jazz musicians into the brain scan, and we had them improvise to faces that had either a smile or a frown or a neutral expression. And we saw that the emotional target clearly affected the brain activity during improvisation, even though they were still improvising.
Wow. Yeah. What was the difference between the smile and the frown?
Yeah. So in the smile, actually, we had more deactivation of the prefrontal cortex. So it was more similar to what was going on in this regular flow state. In the frown, it was actually diminished. And we saw that the frowny faces were associated with a different form of reward mechanism. So we had reward areas of the brain that were active in these sad regions. And so this gets to this whole idea of both multiple pathways that the brain can get derive pleasure, but also this idea that things that are sad or aversive can, especially through the arts, become pleasurable. And so,
wow. Yeah. That's fascinating. Does musical training actually affect the architecture of the brain?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, yes. So talk to me about that. How does that work?
So many ways, and I think many ways that still have yet to be determined, but a couple of things. Generally speaking, musicians are far better at listening, even though their hearing is not really, or not as far as we know, any better. So meaning if 10 musicians go take hearing tests, they don't have supernormal hearing test performance. They just have normal hearing tests, or even sometimes worse than normal because they've had all this noise exposure.
Right.
But their brain's ability to process sound and to handle auditory information is vastly superior. And so a lot of my colleagues at different universities have looked at the impact of early musical training on things like sound processing later on in life. So, for example, Nina Kraus here in Chicago did some work on that in an impressive original work that shows that musical training really changes the brain fundamentally. Now, there's also a lot of data that shows that the neuroplasticity of the brain is really engaged through playing an instrument. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, like the motor cortex of a violinist's left hand is far expanded because that's the hand that they're using to place their fingers on the fretboard. And so sorry, the fingerboard. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think that it goes on and on and on. Musical training seems to change not only the physical structure of the brain, but also the brain throughout time, and then also the functional activity of the brain real time.
So that has to be true for a variety of artistic expressions, likely, right, that just haven't been studied.
I think so.
So that could be dance, that could be the visual arts, sculpting, improvisation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I think that we are just beginning to figure out how these other arts are all sort of unified in the brain.
Right. You're also, would you call yourself a sort of a musical historian, or is that just a passion? Is that a hobby?
I'm a total sound junkie, and so I'm really obsessed by all things auditory, and that, the history of music, but also the history of medicine as it pertains to music, has always been really interesting to me.
Oh, okay. So, like, if you go back to, you know, history and some of the early ways people are figuring out what's going on with the human ear, is there stuff that pops for you?
Oh, yeah. It actually, first of all, I'm amazed at both what they knew and what they were able to figure out, but also what they couldn't do. And so it's amazing to think that there was no way to visualize the eardrum back, you know, even in Beethoven's time, no reliable way to see the eardrum. And so there, as a result, it's not that surprising that the way that people tried to treat hearing loss is by basically sticking funnels in your ear canal and maybe ear-shaped objects in your ear canal in the hopes that you would hear better. So the knowledge was very primitive not that long ago. Mm-hmm. And so we've gained a tremendous amount of knowledge as to how the actual ear works. And you can kind of see when you go back through the history of modern medicine, these leaps and bounds that have happened, and we're witnessing it right now. I mean, we now have a surgical treatment for deafness that used to never actually we couldn't treat severe hearing loss like we can now.
Well, and Beethoven being an example of that, right?
Yep. If Beethoven were alive today, he would probably get a cochlear implant, and he would probably be pretty upset at it because while it would give him speech, it would not do much for his music.
How? Why?
So cochlear implants are amazing. Okay, so let's just start with that. They have revolutionized the treatment of hearing loss. They're the only truly successful neuroprosthesis to date. More than 400,000 people in the world have received them, but they are far from perfect. And it turns out that speech is a much simpler auditory signal than music. And so these implants are optimized and designed for speech. And so they do a pretty good job of providing speech information. So most people that get them can speak, and their lives are pretty good from that perspective. But the radio or the symphony or the club or any concert, really, that's where things start to get very tricky because pitch information is really distorted in a cochlear implant, and even timbre information, so the what an actual instrument sounds like, the tone color, how you tell apart a violin from a clarinet, that's incredibly challenging for a cochlear implant user.
So if you have that implant, can you not hear music?
You can hear the sound that's being played to you, but it's not accurate. So
not pleasant?
Well, that's a different question. So
okay.
Now, there are many patients that respond differently, but by and large, patients have severe pitch limitations. They either the implants are out of tune, or they don't have pitch resolution, meaning they can't tell the difference between one note and the next note, so it's neighbor note. So you don't have the ability to just play every key on a piano keyboard and be able to hear that they're all different. Even if you can tell that they're different, they're not necessarily different in an accurate way.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this whole idea of sound quality because the quality is just greatly reduced.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, it's not acoustic hearing. And so we have to keep in mind what we're actually doing. We're stimulating the brain, the auditory nerve, and then the auditory cortex of the brain using electricity. And so it just was never designed to handle something as complicated as music. And so in order for us to be able to provide music, which I call the pinnacle of hearing, so I believe if we can hear music, we should be able to hear anything. Conversely, if we design a cochlear implant system or enable, finally, a cochlear implant system to process music, we should be able to enable somebody with hearing loss to hear anything.
Are people working on that now?
Yeah, I am. So my lab is actively working on it. It's one of our real big areas of inquiry. But there are several labs around the world that are starting to turn towards music. It was an under-recognized topic, you know, in the past decade. But I would say in the past 2-3 years, there's growing importance. And now it's becoming a sort of a mainstay of cochlear implant research, where it used to be considered sort of a bit of an outlier.
You know, it's interesting. We work so hard in our improv classes to teach people to use the listening that they have, because we don't use the listening we actually have very well. I think there's testaments to that all around us, in business, in life, in relationships. And when we give these exercises out to our clients and our students, the level of happiness that comes back to us and in them is off the charts, simply because it's almost like getting glasses when you didn't realize you had a seeing problem. I don't think most people realize they have a hearing problem.
Hmm. Yeah, I can see that. And also, I'm sure that the level of communication and sort of empathic bonding that takes place between two people that are, you know, successfully improvising with one another is probably just an amazing feeling, because you're really connecting on a level that you're not used to in ordinary life.
Yeah, and those group dynamics are hard. With jazz and improvised jazz in particular, you know, that's where the ensemble becomes something that transcends the individual. Mm-hmm. Because we know these sort of great individual artists, and we sort of honor their craft and skill. But then the people who can play with each other and the kind of discoveries that they make in the moment, that does feel magical. And I would agree, it's not magic. Mm-hmm. It comes out of practice and comes out of a craft, but mostly practice, mm-hmm. In sort of believing those rituals.
And that might be why the drum circle, you know, a simple thing like, you know, sitting mm-hmm. around drumming together has been pretty effective in terms of a therapeutic option.
Yeah, totally. I was, you know, looking up your work, and you had a really lovely quote, and it was someone asked you to write about writing. And you wrote, "I write in order to try to capture my better thoughts, to freeze them in time so that they may be processed by others." Which I thought was kind of lovely, and want to sort of get underneath that a little bit.
Yeah. I feel like my whole life has been, in a way, a race against the clock. You know, I think that as you're growing up and you actually finally realize that, like every other human, you're going to die one day, you start to feel like there's a big countdown. And so for me, in a strange way, music was the embodiment of that countdown, because there's no way to listen to music without the passage of time. So at the moment you try to listen to music, you're devoting time to it. You can't freeze it and stare at it the way you can do that with a painting, for example. Mm-hmm. And so listening to any sound, but music in particular, it's always linked to the passage of this time and this idea that it's one directional. And so with writing, what I noticed when I was, you know, a kid, and you have a million thoughts, but then every once in a while, one thought seems better, more profound, more compelling, better articulated. And then I would write that down, and then it might represent kind of how I thought about the world for that month or even that year. And when I looked back on it 5 years later, 10 years later, I thought, I'm so glad not only that I had that thought, but that I wrote it down, because it was one of my better thoughts of the year and allowed me to sort of recover that time that I lost.
It's risky to write the stuff down, though, too. And I think about just this. So we're taping this a week after the election of Donald Trump. And my particular social media feed is filled with people who previously felt very like-minded yelling at each other over words that they put to try to respond to this thing.
Yes, that's a complicated topic. well, you know, I think that, you know, words can obviously be dangerous and powerful and personal. And for me, when I talk about writing, because I've never been in a political sphere, I was really writing for a much more, in a way, selfish reason, which was to understand the world I was living in. Mm-hmm. And nobody can, I think, criticize me that as a adolescent, my thoughts weren't correct, right? I mean, they were what they were. And so even today, I think as an adult, I still hope that I can try to somehow preserve my better thoughts, whether it's through science or whether it's through writing a piece of music or through talking with you here. I mean, somehow I want to, like all of us have mundane thoughts throughout the day that won't really amount to much. Mm-hmm. And then every once in a while we come up with something that's worth saving. And maybe that's true with all art too.
Oh, yeah.
And so I see that there's some parallel there.
Yeah, absolutely. One of our guests on the podcast is a fellow named Brian Bannon, and Brian runs the Chicago Public Library System here. And as I was researching Brian, I discovered that he had a significant learning disability, something that we recognized with our son Nick was that he used to listen to books on tape, and that was the way he loved stories and loved literature, but it was hard for him to read. And as I was talking to Brian about this, he pulls out his headphones and showed me. He's like, yeah, actually, most of my emails come to me in sound form. And I was sort of curious if there is a difference in the brain when you're reading with your eyes or when you're reading with your ears.
Absolutely.
What is it? What is the – because I think – well, I'll lead this with what – because I think many of us sort of think that when we read with our ears, it's fake reading. We're not really reading. I think there's a societal misconception in my mind. I'm curious what you know about this.
So my sense of that is that reading is the wrong term in that situation. Yeah. So this is all about how the brain acquires information. Right? Mm-hmm. And so we have these limited number of senses, and through these sensory systems, our brain tries to learn about the external world. Some of those things are visual. Some of those things are written. Now, the written word is it's a refinement of modern human civilization. This is not something that is very primitive. Certainly, whereas hearing the auditory world is very natural to how we survive. Okay, so you can't argue that what was essential for cavemen to survive was that they had print,
right,
for example. It eventually helped them to dominate and to really grow and to spread knowledge, but the ability to see, to avoid certain dangers, the ability to hear, to likewise understand the environment was essential. Now, when we sort of take that and we extrapolate that out to modern day society, I think it's very reasonable that there be some people whose strength is auditory processing, mm-hmm, and other people whose strengths are in visual processing. And some people can take in a phenomenal amount of information through reading. Basically, their visual system is really optimized for symbol interpretation. They've either trained it that way or they're naturally, their brains are accustomed to it. And other people, not so much. Mm-hmm. And they would much rather get that same information through the auditory system. And, you know, you can argue that the way the brain stores knowledge is different in these two mediums, in the same way that when you think about a book you've read, you don't necessarily think of sounds. Mm-hmm. When you think about a song you heard, you don't necessarily think of an image. Mm-hmm. And even though the song might have been about the same thing that the book might have been about, and so you can tell that your brain is recording these things in a different way.
Hmm.
And so I think that I'm not surprised at all that there are people who prefer one sensory system of input. I mean, I certainly prefer an auditory system of input for a lot of things. But as I mentioned, I think when it comes to efficiency of taking in information, reading has just been so well optimized in our lives that for many people it's the fastest way to get the kind of information they want.
When you're so immersed in the study of hearing, does it change how you hear and how you listen on a day-to-day level?
You know, I've wondered that. I don't think so, other than the fact that I think it makes me appreciate it more.
Sure.
And so, you know, I'm still really struck every day that I get to hear something like music. I love it. And I do feel a little scared sometimes that one day I won't be able to because I see this in my patients. Mm-hmm. And, I'm rapidly heading towards middle age. And so I can just imagine that as my hearing deteriorates, I'll start to feel a loss. But I view it like, to me, the more you understand something, the more fascinating it gets, not the less. And so it certainly doesn't take any of the sort of childlike fascination and excitement I have to with music. I mean, it's it's an emotional thing. It makes me happy.
Yeah. We spent Charles was over at Second City today watching some people improvise. And I've been doing this for nearly 30 years. I still derive incredible joy out of seeing people do these games that I've seen for decades, that I've seen the best people do. And it doesn't matter. It's in that time and place because we will never see that again. What they improvised was what they had in the moment, and it's like fireworks. It's gone. But the thing that you're sort of holding on to is the joy of the connection and the joy of the performers. And I think that's what, you know, all great art does in a certain degree. And like you're talking about, for some of us, that's going to be music, and some of us, that's going to be theater, and some of us, it's going to be comedy, and some of us, it's going to be novels. Mm-hmm. And we find our joy, and that becomes part of our life story.
Or food.
Or food.
Yeah, I was giving an example. You know, if I studied taste bud physiology, it wouldn't change my enjoyment of a great meal.
No, that's true. So at the end of these podcasts, we always ask our guests if they've got a yes and story. So the explanation there is that the sort of ground zero rule in improvisation is to make something out of nothing. You can't say no. You can't just say yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute. Okay. And what we find is that many people in their life at some point were presented with a thing that was probably going to be a no, but instead they didn't just yes it, they yes anded it. And it changed things, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. And I'm curious, looking back in your life, is there a yes and story that might stick out?
Definitely. So when I first started in my career, there was no significant precedent to study music either as an ear surgeon or even really as a scientist. I mean, there just wasn't a lot of people in the world doing this. And so when I was speaking to my mentors at the time, none of them who were interested in music, their question to me was, are you sure you should be doing this? Mm-hmm. Well, is it too risky? Is it too fringe? Is it too out there? And my answer was yes. And not only should I be doing it, it's going to be great because I love it. It makes me happy. I would think about this stuff even if I were not at work. And in the end, I think that we're going to gain new knowledge about hearing, the brain, creativity that we've never had before, but we've badly needed. And I still feel that way.
That's great. Charles Lim, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. Well, I've been working in a coal mine, going down.